Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Tech, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
How many times can I, man, watch the sunrise over his head? Without feeling free, how many words will fail me in my negligence to arrest? Oh yes, this crazy part of me. How many fools will I let unlock the door to my heart when I know that they shouldn't have had the key? It's been so long and the groove in my heart's nearly gone. Oh, my head's in the clouds, but I'm landing on my feet.
Sunshine, shine down. Now there's a hole in my soul.
And those were the sounds, dear listeners, specifically of Jamiroquai, with Hot Tequila Brown first up, and then followed by Talada from the same album. That came out way back in 2005, to be exact. It was, the album itself specifically was something that I was sort of like searching for a long time. At that particular stage, because, you know, hard physical copies of CDs had ended primarily by, 2010? You know, just by 2015 at least. And it was difficult to find, you know, these particular albums specifically of yesteryear or previous periods. But, besides the particular digression there, it comes from the 2005 album of Jamiroquai by the name of Dynamite. Famously also where, the song that he had at the stage, or that the band had at the launch of this album back in 2005, I remember, was something that many particular musical, commentators thought was out of character of, specifically JK. He's the front man of Jamiroquai. If you didn't know, Jamiroquai is actually a band. And not the name, and not the stage name of the guy. He's JK. That's all. And on that note, dear listeners, welcoming you to my Sunday morning take here on this, not so cold, but chilly, Sunday morning session, specifically here as we are battling through the midway part of the month of July. And, as we always do specifically here, we're taking a look at various particular events, various particular subjects, various particular developments, in this particular period of your Sunday morning programming. And if you've woken up early, dear listeners, I do hope that you've got something hot or something warm, to drink on, to sip on while you're listening to this morning's particular session, and that you wrapped up cold, or that you wrapped up warm, not cold. Sorry, you can't be wrapped up cold. I'm sorry. that would be just for, unfortunately giving the wrong advice at this particular time in the morning. Now, you might sense that I'm slightly a little bit more upbeat specifically, primarily because we are looking at a particular sports event. It's currently happening. It's currently ongoing. But on the 19th of July, 1903, the very first Tour de France was raced, and it was won on the 19th of July. And this happened when the French cyclist, well, the word they use here is bicyclist, Maurice Garin, won the first Tour de France, which covered 2,428 kilometers at the time. Now, we're not talking about Garin, we're talking about the activity he participated in, which is the Tour de France, or the event that he participated in, that is the Tour de France. The Tour de France is labeled as the marquee cycling event for cyclists, professional cyclists, to participate in every year, annually, during the month of July itself. And, well, if you're going to ask me specifically about the current cluster of cyclists taking place, I'll tell you I don't know much of them unless a few of the host names a few of the household names like, what's that guy's name? Bradley Wiggins, the Englishman. If they are still cycling, but I see it's now a new cluster, collection of cyclists that have come through. The guy leading currently is from the Balkans, and there's a whole bunch of new cycling teams there, because the team that he cycles for literally is sponsored by the UAE, because it's got the UAE something Emirates something name. That's the team's name. And there is now also Red Bull is also taking part as a co-sponsor of a team. Because Red Bull is busy, promoting and buying into a lot of sports that have an extreme, endurance, element to it. If you don't know, the energy drinks Red Bull, they're into football, they're into, they're into motorsport, because from F1 to what's the other thing's name that they've bought into, they bought a team, they established a team, and they start strategic partnerships around it. They're into extreme sports, like I mentioned, or, you know, these particular other, you know, action sports, as they would be called, like mountain biking, what's that, cliff diving. There's the other one that they also love, the BMX and skateboarding activities or events. And they're into this whole cluster, and as well as also winter sports. Let me not forget winter sports. And yeah. Now, the particular indications, obviously, from what you would see in the Tour de France of this year specifically, is that it is it is ramping up to be probably one of the most entertaining Tour de France so far. However, the activity itself is more than 100 years old, the competition, and it has, developed itself to being the particular calendar event for cyclists every year. Now, the Tour de France is one of three major events in the world that most cyclists look out for. And I'm talking about endurance cyclists. I'm not talking about these things that we do here in Namibia, and stuff like that. It's actual cycling. It's not a one day event. It's multi-day, 20-day competitions, that you have to look forward to. The Tour de France obviously is the longest one, but you also get in Italy, the Giro d'Italia, as well as in Spain, the La Vuelta a España, that both also feature as major calendar events. Now, both the Giro and the Vuelta happen before the Tour de France. They don't happen during the same time as the Tour de France. The reason why I just highlighted to you the prominence of this particular activity, and in many cases, the other two are used as springboards or as preparation setups, you know, to participate in the Tour de France. Now, as Maurice Garin obviously won the very first Tour de France back then, it is obviously gone from leaps and bounds primarily in terms of the sport developing itself. Now, just to share with you specifically who the new caliber or, class of cyclists are, the guy currently leading the Tour de France today is known as Tadej Pogačar, and he rides for the UAE Team Emirates XRG, while his teammate Isaac Del Toro of Mexico, who is 36 seconds behind him on the leaderboard specifically for the current Tour de France that will end, I think it's on the 26th. I think this one ends on the 26th, the current Tour de France. And this primarily is as the latest stage of the Tour de France, obviously, has seen great particular entertainment. This is as Pogačar himself has won at least four stages in this year's tour. Now, it is not just against the particular clock or the competitors that you are racing against. In cycling, specifically endurance cycling, the kind that the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, and the La Vuelta a España are all about, is that it is you against yourself and your body. It's not just against the other teams and the other riders that you're facing off, and as well as also the team, the time trials that you have to experience. All three of these particular events push the cyclist's particular endurance limits to the core. It's known, that's one of the reasons why it is known as these three races, but the Tour de France is the longest one. Why they are known as the most intensive cycling activity, because of the particular strain that your body goes under. I once saw a particular photo of a cyclist's legs, but these professional guys, you would not believe, guys, the veins, how the veins literally were, you know, protruding on the man's legs because of the amount of cycling that they had to do. Yes, in many scenarios, you would ask me, yeah, Dwight, maybe it's just how the person is, you know, how the person is how the anatomy reacts to whatever activity that they probably were doing. You're right. But obviously, when you're looking at this, the kinds of distances that the cyclists have to cycle, I mean, the current stage that finished yesterday was 155 kilometers long. And if you're going to ask, and if I'm going to ask you, so what do you think your legs will look like after cycling 155 kilometers? You cycled up as well as down. It's not just level, a level course that you are following. You're also cycling long distances. And this is the particular discussion. I mean, guys, imagine cycling to Rehoboth and back, which is 180 kilometers. Imagine cycling that much. I mean, there are long stages in the Tour de France, and the particular scenario obviously is that the event is about showing off who can cycle, who can maintain the maintain dominant levels of performance in competition, as well as also achieve, obviously, and win the yellow jersey. We will get into the particular developments in the history of the Tour de France itself. The Tour de France, besides the yellow jersey, which is the leader's jersey, there's also various jerseys that are also associated to various activities. For example, like the King of the Mountain, as they would call it. There's a King of the Mountain jersey, I think. But I know there's a time, there's a polka dot jersey. The polka dot jersey is either for King of the Mountain or for the steeplechase, or the, you know, the guys that they cycled to. It's a very short stage that they would have, and it was all about setting a particular time limit in terms of the fastest and so on. Now, that obviously sets us for the particular, you know, discussion around the existence and the emergence of the Tour de France. It actually has a very fun and a very interesting background in terms of its origins and how it started off. And we will get into that, dear listeners, right after the musical break. Somewhere they can make it rain.
Diamonds in the night sky, I'm like a child. All alone, beaten up, free. Back in myself.
Coming back there from the sounds of the Future Islands with the song The Fight. Before that, you heard a little bit of The War Against Drugs with the song Knocked Down. Now, where we left off, obviously, we were taking a deep dive primarily about the Tour de France itself, since in history, you know, 19 July was the first ever win of the first ever Tour de France itself, and specifically this particular cycling tradition has continued ever since for more than 100 years. I mean, 1903 is pretty far away. It's more than 123 years old right now. Now, if we obviously look in terms of where this particular event had its origins, where it came from. And remember, this event of the Tour de France itself has defined also how specifically sports science also happens. If you don't know what sports science is, I'll let HD explain that particular part. If you guys didn't know, that's his particular forte itself. I won't get into sports science now. But it is also the Tour de France has also led specifically to various particular developments in terms of measuring, the strain and the particular impact that the human body experiences, when put under a, you know, severe sort of like strain to endure, cycling, the activity of cycling, not to walk, not to run, which in its own right, also they've also measured, what sets the Kenyan marathon runners also apart from many other particular marathon runners. So, you know, sports scientists also went in there to try and look at how do these guys train, what are their diets, what are their daily routines, the same too also for the cyclists. Now, the Tour de France itself, and the lovely thing is that I've got here in front of me, to my benefit primarily, is that there's a photo here of a cyclist of yesteryear, known as Miguel Indurain. Indurain was a Spanish cyclist. I say was, because obviously he doesn't, he doesn't compete anymore. And one of the particular impacts that he obviously contributed was that he won the Tour de France for 3 times in a year. This happened in the 90s. No, not 3 times in a year, sorry, for 3 years in a row. And this is obviously the particular kind of, he's sort of like one of the heavyweights of the competition itself. Now, the Tour de France is known as the world's most prestigious and most difficult bicycle race to compete in. Of the three foremost races, because the other two, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, you have the Giro d'Italia and the La Vuelta a España, the Tour de France attracts the world's best riders. It's not to say that the world's best riders don't ignore the other two, but you will sometimes see them preparing in the other two, or depending on how the other two are positioned, you'll see them actually start off in the one, have a rest period and then participate in the Tour de France, like in the next month. So, if you had to look at when the Giro d'Italia actually took place for this year, because I know it ultimately comes before before the Tour de France. So this year's Giro d'Italia was in May, so the whole of May from the 8th to the 31st. And if you had an opportunity to look at the Vuelta a España, this probably would be in the next month, in terms of coming probably in August or September. Yeah, because this year it's running from the 22nd of August and to the 13th of September. Now, the funny thing is, the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France are both separately approximately a month long. Approximately. The La Vuelta, España, is slightly shorter. For this year, it's slated to run from 22 August to 13 September. Now, as you can obviously see, if the Tour de France, which would end specifically either in this week or in next week, in terms of where the actual, you know, dates are, if it ends primarily it doesn't actually say it outright here, but if it ends like in this week or next week, the cyclists technically have like a week and a half, actually 2 weeks to just recuperate, rest a little bit, and then specifically be ready for the main, or the next particular main event. Now, what the obvious particular scenario from this discussion is that with the Tour, you can clearly see that the Giro d'Italia is positioned before the TDF, and the La Vuelta España is positioned after the TDF, so that it basically features the three main European events to take place. Now, I had this conversation with Hende a little bit earlier, not in this week. No, it wasn't this past week. It wasn't this past week. Asking him just primarily about, you know, do we know off the top of our heads, you know, for example, myself being a sports enthusiast as well, do I know of any other prominent global endurance cycling events? I know South Africa has one or two or three, but they probably have like a whole collection of them. But do they have the same prominence specifically like the Tour de France, or like the other two particular European calendar events? And then your response immediately would be a resounding no, because it's easier to forget the other smaller events. Now, when the Tour obviously started off, and how it basically formed, the particular format that it obviously take, is that it is staged for 3 weeks in each year, in the month of July. Usually it's over 20 day long stages, never taking place at night. And the Tour also typically comprises of about 20 professional teams that each have about 9 male riders in it. And it covers at most 3,600 kilometers. Now, remember, the very first Tour de France covered about 2,400 kilometers. And the current Tour de France obviously, has grown in commercial, prominence, as well as also it has become, a lot bigger, attracting more people from around the world. Primarily, many of the cyclists that you see are now from America, Australia, Europe, South America. Who else is there? There's very few from Asia and the Middle East. There's very few from Africa. I know there was a South African attempt, you know, like a South African team, A bunch of corporate companies try to put something together to get a cycling team to Europe. The downside, obviously, is that is that you obviously these are guys that have to be professional cyclists, meaning you've got to pay these people, you know, like an annual salaries. You know, you've got to pay them throughout the year. This is not just about you prepare every 6 months to for the middle of the year, fly over to Europe with your site, with your bicycles and your team, and then you go and compete there. And then the second half of the year, that's now from September to Christmas, you do nothing. No, these guys have to train consistently every single day. So, the much of the particular stages of the race have taken place mainly in France, but has also included brief visits to Belgium, to Italy, to Germany, and to Spain. There was one time that they started back in 2007. They started a stage in England. And this is obviously when England hosted the opening stage for the first time. It does happen sometimes that they do start the race, the actual, annual event of the rate of the Tour de France in a neighboring country to France. For example, like I mentioned, Belgium, Italy, Germany, and Spain. And obviously the UK can be considered like a neighbor, even though there's water between the UK and France. But back in 2007, they obviously had that particular, significant start, in terms of starting the competition, with a sort of like initial stage in the UK itself. Now, taking a look specifically, the tour itself is deemed within France as a premier sporting event. Yes, in terms of sporting events, in terms of national sports, and also the national pride of a country, France is a bit of a mixed bag of that nature. France and Australia and well, the British who probably created much of the sports in the world, they don't technically have a national sport scenario. Yes, the majority of the country probably follows, you know, football because of the UK's rich football history, but then Italy is on the same level as them, Germany is on the same level as them. Definitely, France has similarly deep roots of football, but you know, the other countries you can quickly identify what is the national sport. And when it comes to the UK, or specifically to England in the UK, you don't hear that kind of a conversation. They will tell you, yes, they have more people participating in this sport. Or this particular sport obviously has a lot more, prominence because it is deemed as a national sport. If you go to South Africa, it's a mixed bag in terms of national, which one of the big three is like on national, status level. So South Africa is a mixed bag of three sports. All three, if you think of them as the big three, you can put up there as these are the national sports of the country because they compete at the highest levels in the top, and they're probably, you know, one of the top performers except for their football. Rugby and cricket, obviously within the top 10 of the top 10 rugby playing and cricket playing countries. But when it comes to football, obviously we've seen most now what happened in the World Cup. You know, South Africa can't claim any sort of like prestige there. But yeah, so you see such particular scenarios. Now, when it comes to the Tour de, when it comes to France, France has a national sport. France has a best performing national team, which is the football team. And then France has a marquee sports event, which is the Tour de France. The whole country is excited for the tour. Now, I told you, they have a national sport. which they love a lot more. And it's not football. It's unfortunately rugby. That's France's national sport, rugby. Then they have a best performing sport, which is the football, which they perform the best in because they've won World Cups before in that sport than they've won in rugby. And they're still trying to get there. And possibly next year they might make it actually because it does seem like they are now getting their ship and their boat and their affairs in order specifically since last year by building up the particular national team, that could, you know, participate at the level of the World Cup next year. Obviously it's a World Cup Namibia is not qualified for because, you know, we were making jokes as always, in one way or another. So the Tour de France features as a marquee event, as a major annual event for France, the whole country, because it is a sport that goes through the whole country. The whole of France gets to see the competition. Guys, imagine for how long you've got 3,000 kilometers of road network to find, to basically position a competition within. 3,000 kilometers of road network. Yeah, you might have an opportunity of hosting such a particular event for Namibia, but we don't have our secondary road networks are all gravel. If you don't know what happens in the Tour de France is that predominantly they use a lot of the secondary road networks throughout France. In Namibia, our secondary road networks are technically a bunch of gravel roads. They don't get onto like major highways like the B1, Khutarsa. They don't get onto those highways much. Sure, it might cross over at a particular segment of the race itself. And then, you know, that part of the highway is temporarily closed. But that's just what the police and the traffic departments of the police are there for. They will find a way to coordinate traffic past or away from the, you know, Tour de France event course itself. So, the tour itself has been watched by huge crowds by road, right next to the roadside, and is also televised around the world. That's obviously one of the supreme tests of athletic endurance. Part of the difficulty for the cyclists, or that the cyclists face in the tour, is that it is divided among time trial racing and racing stages covering both flat land and great stretches of mountainous inclines. Now, there's a lovely thing that they have known as King of the Mountain, which is one of the it's a race within a race, primarily to prove who's the best mountain climber of the cyclists, you know, cycling uphill. And guys, for those of us that have cycled in our previous lives before, we see the pains that those guys go through, and you instantaneously sit there experiencing some format of trauma from cycling uphill for too long. You guys, a lot of us obviously would know what it feels like cycling uphill, for those of us that remember what a bicycle still feels like. And just think of the numbing feeling that your legs experience in that particular time. And these guys make it look like it's not a joke. Now, the King of the Mountain competition obviously is like a handful of the particular stages. It's not a dominant part of the race, because much of the race is technically based upon time racing. You set a time. Obviously, if you are first and you win, you are number one, because that technically means that you were faster than everybody else after you. But the whole reason why it's known as an endurance race, this 20-day competition, or close to 20-day competition, is technically that You are building up a time. And you've got to make sure that your time stays competitive enough. So if you ended today's race with an hour and 30 minutes and 17 seconds, you've, and the race tomorrow is timed at being, on average, an hour long. You've got to make sure, you either meet that or you are quicker than that. And that then also builds up. And everyone after you, they primarily get clocked against your time because you would be sort of like, you know, the main competitor that everybody's competing against. Hence the endurance factor as well. Now, it is noted sometimes, in terms of rare cases, where a cyclist who can perform well at both the time trials and the mountain climbing, they're very rare cases. There was a guy that competed against, what's his face? Lance Armstrong, a lot, a German. He was known because he was, in terms of height, he was bigger than Lance Armstrong. He was known for being a good mountain cyclist, specifically in the Giro d'Italia or in the La Vuelta a España. And also in the Tour de France, and he had pretty good, you know, ability to climb. However, in terms of distance, Lance was known before, obviously, it was discovered that Lance was actually a major, doper, a major cheater himself, because he did cheat, unfortunately. I've even got a list here of the various winners of the Tour de France itself, and it is cited specifically that, you know, he is the winner, but obviously remember that he had to return the titles and the money, which is about 41 million or so, I think, in terms of what he did. But it's very rare for a cyclist to dominate both categories of the Tour de France. Mountain cycle, the mountain climbing, or the race climbing, and the trials, the time trials throughout the particular competition. Now, those who can, you know, when they lead the race, or when they lead, not the peloton, the peloton is literally in the race itself. The peloton is like a major cluster of, the cyclists together. But when they do lead the race, they usually get a symbolic yellow jersey. Of victory, and obviously this is at the end of the particular race when the race ends in Paris, and they have to cycle around the Arc de Triomphe and down the Champs-Élysées. If you don't know, these are two main features in Paris. The Arc de Triomphe is something that, Napoleon Bonaparte built. And the Champs-Élysées is the street that he also built in Paris, basically, to feature, you know, at that stage, the Grand Army of the French, when he was busy, you know, doing his thing there in Europe, having wars left, right, and center. So, yeah, so the end of the race takes place in France, or they come into Paris, sorry, not France, they come into Paris. And they've got to cycle around the Champs-Élysées, no, down the Champs-Élysées, around the Arc de Triomphe, and come back down the Champs-Élysées to finish the race itself in the city of Paris. Now, we'll quickly be taking a short musical break, dear listeners, and we'll be coming back right after that, as we've already crossed over into the second half of this morning's program, where you'll obviously be in my company up until 7 a.m., and we'll be back right after this. Now, as we come back there from the sound specifically of Leon Bridges with the song Blue Messas from his, when was this album? 2020, 2021 album known as Gold Digger's Sound. There is a song on Gold Diggers, but it's not actually a song. It's like a, you know, like a mini connector song between two songs in that scenario. So I'm not trying to, you know, stoke up any particular sort of like, you know, gender wars there, primarily about that label. It's the man's, you know, it's the man's album's name. And yeah, primarily in my particular opinion, it's probably one of his best, in comparison to the other, two albums that he had before this. Now, where we left off primarily about looking at the tour itself, we finished like the, you know, the standard understanding of the thing, you know, not much rules, not too complicated, not overly, you know, convoluted with rules and stuff. You know that there's two formats of the race. You've got to compete in the, not just the time trials, but also specifically in the mountain climbing sessions of the race. But it's a discussion, obviously, of why I called this race 123 years old. Primarily. Well, the tour itself was established in 1903 by a guy by the name of Henri Desgrange. He lived from 1865 to 1940. Now, he himself was a French cyclist and a journalist. Now, just to jog your memory a little bit. Before 1900, there was great enthusiasm by specifically the Europeans about, you know, development of and the use of and the manufacturing of bicycles. And there were a whole bunch of, like, you know, inventions and inventors and creators of various bicycles. Now, at that stage, the, you know, the people around, Europe and also in France, they were cycling everywhere. They would cycle, they would just take their bicycle and decide, you know what, I'm gonna cycle 50 kilometers to Okahania, just for the fun of it. Or they would take up their bicycle and they would cycle 100 k's for the fun of it, let's say to Rehoboth or to Witvlei here on your way to Gobabis. And they would be cycling everywhere. And this is obviously, you know, back then when the human beings, you know, realized, you know what? Why don't we make this a fun activity? Now, Desgrange, being a cyclist and a journalist, he primarily established the race, and it has been run every year except for during the two world wars that obviously happened in human history. And obviously, if you know that the two world wars each were like 4 and 5 years in length, specifically the First World War, 4.5, should I rather say. And with the Second World War, primarily, depending on which side of the world you were in, it was probably 5 or 6 or almost 7 years in length. Because if you were in Asia, 1939 would have been the start of the Second World War. If you were in Europe, 1940 would be the start of the Second World War. So, depending on which particular time period that you're looking at in the world and on which part of the world. So, Desgrange's newspaper, because yes, as a journalist, he decided to have his own particular platform, in terms of that time, was known as Le Auto. But Le Auto, if you go look for it today, is known as L'Équipe. That's the platform's name today, L'Équipe. And it sponsored the tour to primarily boost his own circulation, which is a very clever idea. You know, you have your own media platform, your own media outlet, and in order to bring prominence to your outlet, you sponsor a particular sports event, and this particular sports event then ultimately, you know, has, you know, people talking and bringing prominence and more specific, you know, commercial buy-in, as well as also supportive buy-in from supporters into the event itself. Now, obviously, this particular sponsorship of the tour, and its aim was to boost circulation for his newspaper that he had at the time. Now, two events also sparked spectator interest in the race itself back then when Desgrange launched the tour, was that in 1910, the riders were sent for the first time over the treacherous Circle of Death, in inverted commas, in quotation marks, which is a mountain, which is in the mountain passes of the Pyrenees. And in 1919, which was then also where the race itself marked the introduction of also of the yellow jersey. So up until that particular time, they didn't have indication of the yellow jersey. But you can obviously see that in 1919 is literally the year after the First World War ended. Yellow, the color yellow, and the reason why the jersey was labeled as yellow or is now known as the yellow jersey is primarily because, you wouldn't believe me, but the newspaper that Desgrange had, L'Auto, its paper was yellow. The newspaper paper was yellow. So, it obviously, you know, the positive association in terms of the color, the use of the color, having yellow paper, to signal obviously the yellow jersey in the race itself, which obviously sort of like has great buy-in from the fans when they see this stuff. They know, oh, that yellow resonates with the yellow that we see and read every day, you know, for their daily dose of news and development. Now, as the yellow paper or the color of the paper of L'Auto was obviously, you know, in yellow, but the jersey itself was then also an honor that was accorded to the cyclist who has the lowest cumulative time for the race at the end of the day. Not the highest cumulative time, the lowest. The way I explained it obviously was, you know, taking you obviously to Gorjas and coming back with it. Now, a racer might also win a stage of a race on any given day. It's not always the race leader that wins, you know, every stage every day. But a racer can also win any of the stages on any given day, but will obviously also not necessarily be given the yellow jersey, as that obviously depends on the lowest overall time that you've recorded. And there have been instances specifically, I think it was with, what was the guy's name? The Englishman, Bradley Wiggins. I think it was like with Wiggins. Wiggins was known for not always leading all races or all stages in the race, in the Tour de France. There would be times where his team would be helping him specifically just stay in a specific part of the race itself. Now, like I said, there's a particular phrase I used a little bit earlier in the show, known as the peloton. The peloton is like this, if you've ever watched the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, the La Vuelta a España, you would see there's like the guys at front, in the front, leading the race, and then like either a kilometer or a couple of kilometers behind them, you'd find this mass collection of the other cyclists where they are together, cycling together. That is known as the peloton. The peloton is that massive collection of these cyclists. Now, in many scenarios, you don't want to be stuck in the peloton. The peloton is usually where the support riders are. When I say support riders, these are the fellow teammates of the cycling teams, because you don't just show up with one cyclist. You show up with at least, like you heard a little bit earlier, with at least 9 cyclists. In some cases, it's 5 or 6 or 7, but the highest, obviously, would have been 9 cyclists. That would be your team. These guys train together every year, day in, day out, and then they obviously help coordinate how this, you know, because there are cycling strategies. There are also strategies in cycling specifically. You know, they would designate who is the best mountain, you know, mountain performer who can perform in a mountain climb, who is the best sprinter between them, who is the best long distance cyclist between them. What else is there? There's another one. There's another particular trait that they also look at, specifically to try and understand, of the cyclists. And, this is a particular race I unfortunately have to say, guys, it's just as brutal as rugby. If you are a short guy, like the rest of us, losmar. Just go cycle for fun wherever you find yourself. Losmar. Look, even if you're Kenyan and you can claim that you've got Kenyan genes in terms of running, cycling is a completely different thing. So, like I said, if you're a short guy, just let it go. Just let it go. It was even a bit weird, primarily to try and look at, for example, there's a Mexican guy, was a South American cyclist currently, who participated in one of the particular events of the Tour de France, either last year or the year before that one of the particular versions of the Tour de France that I watched, and I was like, but bruh, I can see that you are too short against many of these other riders, because these other guys are like 1.8, 1.9 meters long, tall, and these guys, in terms of your height, it obviously highlights the ability for you to cycle. If you're shorter, you have to cycle more to keep up with that tall guy who just has to go through, you know, a cycle and a half. And it's, you can clearly see it's one of the particular sports that is just, if you're a short person, losmar. Just go and cycle for fun or go play football. You know, at least there you know that, being short would actually work in your benefit versus in cycling where it's not so, yeah, it's not so cool. So the fastest particular time, in a stage, or actually should I say, the average time, primarily that has been observed during the tour, of a cyclist, and the quickest, this is primarily the quickest that they've measured, oh, this one guy, is the winner's average pace at the time in, what was this? 2022 was a cyclist by the name of Jonas Vingegaard. His fastest winning pace was 42 kilometers per hour, during the 2022 version of the Tour de France. Now, the slowest that they've gone was literally 24 kilometers per hour. This was back in 1919. Remember when I mentioned that it was the first time that they brought, when it came back that they brought in the, yellow jersey. At that stage, the cyclist by the name of Fermín Lambeau, was cycling the slowest at 24 kilometers per hour. Now you can obviously see the difference in terms of performance rate versus today. Reason being, if you're going to ask me, has it always been this slow? Well, during that period between 1913 to 26, 27, they've been there in that low 20s. If you go through the period, through the 1930s up to now modern day period, specifically into 2024, 2025, it has remarkably climbed higher. There have been peaks, there have been spikes of good performance, but the cyclists have just become faster and faster and faster and faster. But I will let you in on a little bit of a secret. So one of my brothers also likes cycling a lot. Okay, actually two of my brothers. And I once sat there listening to them as they were talking about the current trend and the current interest, heightened interest in cycling. And And my elder brother tells my younger brother that the new bicycles come out with a lighter frame. So these times that I'm looking at here can be or are probably associated with the material that the bicycle is made from. Remember, if it was the older, you know, metallic frames, the bicycle is heavier. You are literally, you know, technically gymming your legs on that very heavy, on that heavy bicycle frame. But the new bicycle frames, apparently are being made from a lighter alloy or lighter metal or lighter composition of metals. In terms of, you can literally lift the bicycle with one hand, and technically the handles on the handlebar, the wheels at both ends are the only two things that are heavy, are the only three things that are heavy. So the speeds of the cyclists have been increased, specifically obviously as the manufacturing has improved and thus have introduced a new particular material to be used as the bicycle frame for the athletes. And the only three things technically that now would be heavy is the handles, the two wheels, and probably your seat that the cyclist has to sit on. And that's about it. Because the speeds now, they obviously now achieve higher speeds with these new particular bicycles that have been manufactured, and they obviously aim to, you know, become more competitive. Now, there are three other types of jerseys that are awarded during the tour. You get bonus sprints, which also, you know, also happens during the particular course of the event, and this also then awards both points and a deduction of overall elapsed time, and this is also specifically as there are several sites along the route each day during the particular race that obviously allows for this particular thing. It's almost similar to like what the F1 guys have. They have the DRS period during the race. I don't know if in F1 if they still use DRS, because DRS is like a kinetic energy that they use specifically to give the engine a little bit of a boost, which allows them not to use as much fuel during this particular period. It's a wonderful thing. It looks literally like a Fast and the Furious movie session, but it's only used in a straight line in a specific time of the race course, specifically in F1. Now, it sounds similar to that in terms of these particular bonus sprints. But the winner of the most points also receives a green jersey. This is one of the other particular jerseys that are handed over or handed down in the race itself. So you have the polka dot jersey, you have the yellow jersey, you've got this green jersey. We're getting to the polka dot one now. The polka dot one has, it's white with a lot of red dots on it, specifically so as to indicate the polka dot. So the polka dot jersey is given to the king of the mountains. This is the guy that obviously wins a lot of the mountain races. This is the rider who has the most points in the climbing stages, racing over small hills as well as also steep mountain challenges. Then you get the white jersey, which is awarded to the rider age 25 and under, who has the lowest cumulative time. Now remember, in professional cycling, there is a lot of veterans. I mean, a lot of the top cyclists are in their 30s in cycling. And when I say there's a lot of veterans, these guys just get better and better and better as they, you know, as they are in that 30 plus age range. So yeah, the obvious scenario you would see here is that the Tour de France obviously tries to also promote more youthful participation. Sounds almost like an NDP6 scenario, but they obviously try to encourage more youthful participation and also recognizing youthful athletes who are the up and coming talents. And then you obviously get the riders who usually also have three types of bicycles. There's one for time trials. So now you obviously see that they've got different bicycles. They don't use the same bicycle over and over and over. There's the one bicycle that they would use is for time trials. Then there's a bicycle that they would use for flat road stages, meaning when it's just on flat pieces of the competition. And a very light bicycle that is used for the mountain climbing stages in the race. Now, all the bicycles must meet the standards of the International Cycling Union, which obviously is the, you know, like the governing body of the sport itself. But these bicycles also may be specially engineered for speed for the time trials, but those used for the road stages of the race must be standard design. This is obviously to avoid, technically, any cheating. Now, before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short musical break and we'll be coming back right after this.
Even running around covered in gas, playing with matches, oh. We've been running this thing, running it down, down. Sweetly talking with you and I, we both know. Keep on running it down, the world that we ignore. Stop giving you time. Are you taking your love to another guy? Tell me what he gonna do, what he gonna do. How we gonna make sweet love to you? And if it hurts you now, I'm running and down, running and down.
Running from myself. and stay inside.
Can't forget your kisses, sweet.
Remember how your body feels.
Always was a perfect fit.
I know how you like it.
Sip it down like moonshine.
Holds you in the moonlight.
No one sees me like a babe.
Then your tears roll down my face.
I don't wanna go back.
Girl, don't do him like that. Don't worry about me.
Now we come back there from the sounds of Leon Bridges again with the song Don't Worry. And just where we left off, we obviously looked at the particular sanitization and, you know, some of the particular antics in terms of what the cyclist would use in terms of participating, as well as also what rewards there are. But early teams back then were, when the Tour de France itself began, was sponsored with mainly by bicycle manufacturers. Like I said, you know, there was a time that there was great fanaticism about the product itself. And this was until 1930. Now it's up to you what you can think about what happened in 1930. I clearly know what happened in 1930. That primarily was just before the Great Depression actually occurred for the next 10 years. Now, in 1962, trade teams returned. Now, trade teams, or that phrase, trade teams specifically mean, companies that manufacture stuff that come to sponsor the teams. Now, between 1930 and 1962, national and regional teams were introduced. It's almost like looking at, a team representing the Comas region, a team representing Hartab, Ochidonchupa, so on and so forth. Now, in 1962, obviously, trade teams returned, except for in 1967 and 68, which featured national teams. And trade teams then also continued after that with sponsors, which then migrated or included banks starting to participate, insurance companies and manufacturers of household goods. The team aspect of the tour is also something that has become a main feature of the tour itself, although you'll only have one rider which is awarded the win. The lead riders are technically dependent upon their team members in order to succeed. So if the team wins, there's obviously going to be bonuses that the rest of the riders get. If you don't, obviously it's based upon, the performance agreements that you guys signed. Now, teammates help their leader also with a tactic such as letting him ride, meaning draft behind them, to protect him from the wind. In motorsport, you'll hear this known as slipstreaming. Slipstreaming is technically when, drafting, behind another cyclist or behind another car. The wind pressure is not as heavy on you as the car in front of you that you're busy slipstreaming, or the rider, for example, if it's in cycling, that you're busy drafting behind. But the moment you try to overtake them, whether it be left or right, you will immediately feel the wind pressure coming from the front. The same thing also specifically in motorsport. This particular tactic obviously also gives a teammate, one of the wheels when his bicycle is also experiences a flat tire and the likes. And obviously this also helps with the particular sort of like team strategies and how they develop and how they run. In many scenarios, it's always about how far ahead you are. I've seen in recent years, there's a strategy that they deploy the cycling teams where, if you've got a strong cyclist specifically, doesn't matter which stage it is, there's at least two of you to help specifically with the team tactic or the team strategy in terms of achieving obviously the best particular outcome for the race. Now, this particular strategy is all about, this as teammates obviously help the lead cyclist in their team to try and achieve, the best, particular position and outcome of the race. This is all about setting a strong pace for this lead cyclist in the mountains, chasing down as well as also blocking any other major rivals who have accelerated away from the main group in an attempt also to gain time. But the Tour, and bicycle racing in general is often also referred to as an individual sport that is practiced by teams in terms of the classification, because, you would ask me, is it actually a team sport or is it an individual sport? Many people will technically tell you it's an individual sport, even though they are teams. So, and also what you see primarily is that it's not, there is a team category for the win, when the race is, or the tournament is won, or the competition is won, but everybody knows and recognizes the cyclist who won it, the cyclist who got the yellow jersey. Everyone recognizes that person. They also recognize the polka dot jersey. Everyone recognizes these two particular features of the race. The team comes secondary and the team win. It's the same thing also with F1. If you have to look at F1, if you ask me today, is F1 a team sport or is F1 an individual sport? You would get the same answer. It's technically an individual sport with a team dynamic. Technically speaking. Technically. Now obviously, this has also had a few particular negatives, this particular sport in its own right. The doping scandals that obviously have haunted the sport itself. Most notably, most famously, a good friend, an American who showed the whole world how he cheated while his closest competitors technically were, banned or they were eliminated or disqualified from the race for doping. Now, one of the funny things has been is that it came out from what was discovered of Lance Armstrong's particular dominance of the sport between 1999 and 2005. And you would think this probably looks like a long period. Yeah, it's a 7-year period at most. In that 7 years, he won 5 Tour de France's in a row. And he primarily won it because much of his closest competitors were either disqualified or they were, kicked out of the competition for doping, for using a substance that, channels a lot more oxygen into the muscles. And during the course primarily of Lance Armstrong's particular, I will call it how he was dragged in front of the court of public opinion. it came out primarily that Lance Armstrong had a company, which was the company that technically provided the doping testing, that technically kept on eliminating or disqualifying his closest rivals for every race in that period. Him. So you will immediately also sit there with an idea of going like, huh, okay, so this is what he did. Very clever. However, the doping scandals itself have obviously been a major particular concern for the sport. I primarily, here by 2015, you know, when I heard that the doping scandals were not ending, I sat there thinking to myself, you know, this is probably the only sport that they can literally say, you know what, guys, dope. Just dope. Just use performance enhancing substances, because this is an endurance sport. This is not you running. This is not athletics. This is not whatever. But obviously, because cycling is in the Olympic realm of sports, they obviously have to maintain World Anti-Doping Agency standards, in order to meet specific targets and requirements there. But from my get-go, when I saw since the earliest time period that I began watching Tour de France annually, I just sat there thinking to myself, every year there's a cyclist getting eliminated, disqualified for doping allegations, or the test highlights that the cyclist seems to have something in their bloodstream or in their urine samples that they have to supply, because they take urine samples. It's usually the urine samples that they use. And I just sit there thinking to myself, do these guys, how do you not know what foods, what things, substances not to use and to use that can help you with improving your performance? There was a guy here, what's this guy's name? American Floyd Landis. Landis tested positive for testosterone. He's a man. He's got testosterone in him. This is probably one of the funniest things I've ever heard. He tested positive for testosterone and was stripped of his title after an arbitration panel in 2007 upheld the drug test results. Landis's issue, guys, Landis's issue is if you go and think, okay, so the average man has this particular level of testosterone in his blood, ne? The first thing that I found out from such a particular way of thinking, for example, was what happened to a rugby player from South Africa. What was that guy's name? Was it Kobus Fisagi? But I know his surname was Fisagi. He played for Western Province at the time. And at that stage, you know, it was still the Super Rugby, where South Africa was still participating in the Super Rugby situation with Australia and New Zealand. Now, this Fisagi player, he's a forward in rugby. He was a prop. At that stage, he was one of the up and coming sort of like talents of South Africa. And then the doping guys show up, because they also test the rugby players. The doping guys show up, and because the rugby players have to take so many supplements specifically to help with their metabolism and continuously having enough energy, as well as also being able to hold on to water molecules within their muscles. For example, there was some of these athletes love using creatine, which is the worst kind of supplement to actually use, because it's explained by sports scientists that the thing only traps water in your muscles, between your muscle fibers. Thus, it looks like the guy is buffed up, but it's not actual protein fiber or proteins that actually contributed to the buff look. It's trapped water molecules between the muscle fibers that helps with that buffness. Another scenario is obviously that Contained within those supplements, for example, there might be one or two of some sort of a banned substance that WADA does not approve of for your sports category. WADA is the World Anti-Doping Sports Agency, the World Anti-Doping Agency. And Fisahi was tested. And then it came out in South Africa, obviously. And then, you know, it became this whole sort of like media night storm in South Africa for, because he was on the cusp of becoming a Springbok. And Pimo, he was doing a pretty good job in terms of what he was doing. So Fisahi was interviewed by what's this one particular sort of like doping sports program. And then they interviewed him, and then they asked him, okay, so what happened in your case? And then he said, because he was banned for 2 years at least. Yeah, for 2 years. And after the 2 years, he then decided to go to England or to the Northern Hemisphere to go play rugby there. But in the discussion of what took place was the measurements used for testing an athlete in a specific sport, for example. Now, I'm citing to you cycling, which is an endurance sport. That means you can't be overweight in any direction. Your waist cannot even look like it has a centimeter of fat on it. These guys have no fat on their bodies, cyclists. They have no fat on their body. So this technically means that they have a very controlled diet. They obviously can only eat certain things that give them the best energy levels in terms of what they consume, as well as also that they've got to regularly practice and train. When you come to the rugby players, this guy has to eat four times a day, a rugby player. I'm not saying he nibbles. Homeboy has to eat four times a day. Then they still have to drink a lot of those particular sort of like supplements that help with burning energy, because many cases rugby players are advised to go in, professional rugby players are advised to go in gym. They must have workout sessions in the gym before, you know, prior or after or before actual practice sessions. And Fisahi explained to this journalist that I was measured, that was his words, quote unquote, I was measured on the average man's particular, you know, physique. And the average person's physique does not play a prop position, does not weigh 100 plus kilograms for the sport that they play. And he said, how can you rate me against the specific body physique of an average man, which is slightly slimmer, shorter, probably leaner than him. And he clearly for his body will have heightened levels specifically of these particular, you know, substances within his bloodstream. But he was still tested. He got banned. This obviously shows to you that in many cases when you think about things, there are anomalies that pop up. The one thing that I heard was that sports arbitration courts, specifically the global one, the court for arbitration, the CAS, the CAS, those guys, there's no such thing of thinking of literally being on the same level as a regular national court. There's no such thing. In many cases, the athlete just has to sit still there. He or she can't make a case. They can't defend their side. There's a lawyer that defends you, literally like in a real court case. But the downside is, you had to supply written arguments beforehand, before anything else. Now, obviously, like I explained with Landis tested positive for testosterone. Obviously, And this was in 2007. In 2007, several other teams also withdrew from the tour after their riders all failed drug tests. Alarm bells need to ring there. And that also that year saw Bjarne Riis of Denmark, the 1996 victor, also drop from the tour's list of winners after he admitted using EPO during his race. However, due to time limits for the sanctions, his title could not be officially revoked as well. The most famous, obviously, was of what happened to Lance Armstrong. Was stripped of all his titles, and after an investigation revealed that he had been the central figure in a doping conspiracy during the years in which he won his 5 titles. And ultimately, dear listeners, that does bring us up to the end for this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take. We'll be just be quickly stepping into a short musical break, but after the musical break, we'll be coming back to say our goodbyes and obviously, where you can listen to the rest of, the programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, right after this.